I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
The library is open! It's time for Must Have Seen TV, the podcast dedicated to the sitcoms of the 20th century. From I Love Lucy to News Radio, happy Pride Month from your TV guide, Brett White. And I'm also a reporter, senior reporter producer for Decider.com. At some point, I'm actually going to change it in my script and recognize the promotion that I got a while ago. this is part 3 of 2021's Pride Month extravaganza, talking about a gay episode of television with gay luminaries from all walks of life and professions. And this week I'm joined by someone who has a profession that, I don't know, I feel like in a parallel universe, if I could Loki hop around through timelines, maybe you would have my job. Professor Taylor Miller?
Yes.
Yeah.
Doctor. Doctor is a hard title too.
Wait, hold on. You have a doctorate?
I do. I have a doctorate degree. Oh, University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Why don't you throw that around? Or do you?
I do. And I just... Anytime anyone says, oh, hello, Mr. Miller, I say, oh, I'm sorry. Don't call me Mr. Miller. That's my father's name. I'm Dr. Miller.
Doctor, if you're nasty. what do you have your doctorate in? Tell the listeners about the career that I get to watch from afar via Facebook updates.
Well, I did my undergrad in journalism in Spanish, and then I graduated at the height of the global recession. It was the worst time ever.
We love it.
Yay, millennials. And then I went to the University of Texas Austin for my master's degree in radio, TV, and film. Unfortunately, I missed the Matthew McConaughey years by a few. He's there now. I've heard he's a good faculty member, but doesn't smell the best.
That's wild.
And then I did my PhD at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. 5-year degree just for the PhD, but it was in media and cultural studies. And I trained as a historian, a television historian.
God, yeah. And you teach Golden Girls classes? Am I like...
Yeah, so at the University of Georgia, I had that's the institution I'm just currently leaving to return to Wisconsin. But at the University of Georgia, I had a first year Odyssey class. It's a first year class for freshmen, sort of introducing freshmen to senior faculty in their first year so that they're not buffered just by grad student TAs.
Oh, wow.
And the class was on the Golden Girls and 80s televisual politics. You really can't do better than the politics of the Golden Girls, in my opinion.
It hit one. I mean, during that middle stretch of seasons, it's like every week is like homelessness, AIDS, addiction.
Yeah. Yes. And what I really thought when I taught the class is that I would find all of these young proto-gay college kids who love the Golden Girls and didn't quite understand why. And what actually ended up happening is it was a whole bunch of white moms told their kid, you're taking that class. That's the class you're taking. The Golden Girls. You can take a Golden Girls class. But it was really one really fun thing that emerged from that is that I learned that Monty Markham, who plays Clayton, Blanche's gay brother, mm-hmm. is a graduate from the University of Georgia. And so he zoomed into one of the class and the students, and I interviewed him. And
oh my God.
That was a lot of fun. He just donated his papers to the University of Georgia. So.
Oh my God. Yeah. Like Clayton Hollingsworth is.
Yes.
When I started at Decider in 2017, Joe Reed, who was, who had already been there and I came on that summer, he'd already launched this, the 50 greatest LGBTQ plus characters of all time on television. And when I started, he was like, oh my God, thank God I have someone to actually write like half these blurbs with, because he wasn't going to have to do all of them. And so when I submitted my list, I mean, Clayton might be my number one or number two. Like,
oh, wow.
Like, and again, like that's a deep cut. But again, like I relate so hard to that. I'm from Tennessee. I have a sister who... I have family who maybe the sister of the bride episode feels very relevant to my life. So I always really, really related to his character. And listeners, you can go back and listen to that episode that I did with Frank DeCaro and Jim Colucci last Pride Month. We talked about the great Clayton Hollingsworth.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But no, like you totally have like the gig, because I try to almost do... what you do via my silly things that I write for work, where you're actually taking an academic, methodical approach.
You're a public historian. And a lot of my work depends on the work of people. I mean, here's the thing. When it comes to gay media history, we are a history of silences.
Yep.
And it takes everyone working together at whatever level to do the research to uncover all of these wonderful characterizations that have happened, you know, and that's one of the reasons why I always struggle. I'm very confident when I wrote the piece that we're talking about today, or that, you know, about Soap that we're drawing from today, I was very confident, you know, this is the first lesbian character, you know, where I'm so obsessed with firsts. This is the first, but you end up always contradicting yourself, because you realize, you know, there was some other character that came before. There was some other local channel that really was pioneering. And so I think it's important for all of us public historians, professional historians, to work on these things together and really excavate this wonderfully queer history that is often so buried.
Yeah, and listeners, if you want to know more about this specific thing, please ask questions about Hayden Rourke. I want to do a Q&A episode for the year anniversary of me starting this project, which I do believe is June 23rd.
Well, happy anniversary.
Yeah, it's been a wild year. I'm now 11,000 words into a writing sample, so that feels good. I just scanned 130-something World War II photos of Hayden Rourke and his partner and all their gay soldier friends. Yeah, it's been a wild ride. But, like, again, like, I'm discovering things about I Dream of Jeannie that have not been collected in any of the, like, official tomes, because those books were written 20 years ago and before the internet. And so, like, the guy that wrote that book just didn't have access to all of the wild stuff that I'm coming across. So,
what I would say is, you know, as a professional historian, make sure that you have established your paper somewhere, so that way when you keel over one day, all of the work that you've built in this repository about Hayden go somewhere, and Brett White Jr.'s can go and find them. You know what I mean?
I mean, I found Hayden's archives, which was a big get. I'll be going out to Wyoming at some point to see them in person.
Is that the American Heritage Center?
Oh yeah.
Oh, God. Wonderful.
But also
wonderful.
Hayden, his brother lived in Wyoming. So like he went to visit his family. Like, I think that's also why they're there. But then again, everyone's papers are there. It's a huge Stan Lee's papers are there. I know from my friend who wrote the Stan Lee biography. But we're going to be talking about history because this week we're specifically traveling to January 18th, 1979. Superman ruled the box office. Les Freaks by Chic topped the charts. And ABC aired the soap episode 216. Taylor, you must have seen 216 before today. Gotta love those non-titles.
I went to go look for a title, and that's exactly what it is called. Like Mary Hartman was always the name of every episode was just the date.
Well, that is better than 216. Or you can do the Love Boat thing where every episode has three titles.
Oh heavens.
And it is because they're all three different story arcs written by three different writing teams, and so they all title their own, and then they title the episodes all. It's ridiculous.
Well, if we can give this one a title, it would be the one where the lesbian tries to throw herself off a bridge.
which in some ways would not narrow it down from a lot of TV episodes.
Yeah, that's fair.
What is your history with the soap? Because soap, which is my history with it, is this is the first episodes I've seen, because it was not a Nick at Night show. So I didn't get into it.
Mm-hmm.
Was it a TV sense. Land show? I think it went to TV Land eventually.
It's maybe? Possible. The thing is, okay, so for the viewers who maybe don't understand or who have never seen soap, soap is like a soap opera, right? It is a serialized storyline, which means that the story continues. It never resolves. Soap was basically kind of, in my opinion, no offense, Susan Harris, but mostly a ripoff of Mary Hartman, which was a show by Norman Lear. He wanted it to be a daily soap, a daily primetime soap opera. And the networks all said, no. How about you do the same sort of thing with, you know, installments, but only once a week? And he said, hard pass. So he took that directly to syndication, and the networks, they tasked one of the writers in Norman Lear's stable, Susan Harris, to help create this show, Soap. And so every single episode is just one continuous storyline. One of the Mary Hartman, I think the director of Mary Hartman, said that the serialized storyline is like having sex forever but never being able to come. Like, because it never comes to any kind of resolution. That's what makes talking about one particular episode of soap kind of tricky. Like, the first 20 minutes of this episode probably would not be interesting to most of your viewers, because it's just continued storyline for the two main families in the show. But when we get to, I think, 13 or 14 minutes into the episode, we meet Alice.
Yeah. Well, it's, and like, soap was for also for viewers that, or for listeners that don't know, soap's place in like the sitcom pantheon is like Billy Crystal as Jody was. He wasn't the first. He was like,
right. See, here's the problem.
He was the first on a show that lasted, like on a show that lasted where he was actually a main character in almost every episode, because there was the Vincent Chiavelli in the Corner Bar, but that show only lasted a half season, and he was recurring, I think.
And then Isle of Baltimore had characters too. Yeah, a couple.
Neither of them. Oh, yeah. And so
that was 73, I think.
Billy Crystal being on this show brought a unique point of view on the homosexual
experience. I think it's fair to say he's the best known first.
Yes.
Network gay recurring. So,
so many
sitcom
qualifiers.
But yeah, definitely. Like, I mean, okay. If we couch this in how controversial any of these characters were, Jody's was the most controversial.
Yeah. 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 Well, and also what is fascinating is I do believe like, a bunch of like gay rights groups tried to work with soap, like tried to work with ABC just like on the scripts and like where they wanted to make sure they were being represented well, because like in the first episode, Jody wants to have a sex change or gender reassignment surgery, which is conflated with being a homosexual, which is the kind of like very dated 70s idea of it. Baby steps is what that is.
Yeah. So let me just type. Okay, so when the show starts, Jody's character is basically soap is about two families, one very rich and one working class. And Jody comes from the working class family. Jody, Billy Crystal, Jody Dallas is his character's name.
Which is a great drag queen name, honestly.
Yeah, like, yeah, a gay man. And Jody is dating Olympic pole vaulter Bob Segrin. His character's name is Dennis. And so throughout the beginning of the show, you know, this show was way controversial before it hit the airwaves. And that meant the writers scrambled and kind of neutralized Jody even before the show premiered a little. But often what Jody would say is that, you know, I'm going to have a sex change operation, not because he identified with trans, with the trans identity or with the transgender community, but because somehow in his head and in the diegesis of the show, having a sex change operation would make it acceptable for him to be with Dennis. You know, ultimately Dennis leaves him, and as the show goes on, they do some really bizarre things to Jody's character, including putting him in relationships with women. So most often what I found when I was writing about soap, or when I was first watching soap, was, you know, if you look at all these queer history books, everyone's interested in Jody in those first few episodes.
Yeah.
And the show, you know, lasted for several seasons. So throughout the course of the show, Jody gets less and less and less gay.
Yeah, and there's incidences of that kind of in these like two-ish, this one plot line. It's not really an episode that we're talking about today.
So he ends up with, you know, having a one-night stand with a woman, and they have a child. And he never is bi. He's never bisexual. It's, you know, it's in some ways, it's kind of a really fascinating portrait of queer life. And queer and gay meaning something more than just these rigid positions that we typically assign them in American broadcast history. And that's what I find really interesting about Alice. So Jody meets Alice on the Triborough Bridge. She's about to kill herself. She's writing her suicide note, and she's distracted because he's, you know, doing the soap opera thing where you're monologuing all your problems. She's like, how can I focus on this suicide note when she's trying to throw yourself over the Triborough Bridge? And what's really captivating about that moment is the two are having this conversation on the bridge about their problems, and he essentially says to her, it gets better.
Yeah.
And so when I was watching this series, it was at the exact same time that the Dan Savage It Gets Better campaign was, you know, at its height, trying to prevent, you know, gay teen suicide. And so I was just wondering, wow, we've really been telling queer people it gets better for at least 35 years. That's kind of insane to think about. And so I just ended up calling up the actor who portrayed Alice, and her name's Randy Heller. Most people probably know her as Dawn
Mrs.
Draper's
Blankenship,
elderly secretary.
Oh, Mrs. Blankenship. Yeah, iconic. Love.
She also played Lucille LaRusso in The Karate Kid. She was the Karate Kid's mom. Wonderful, wonderful actor, and a real delight to speak with. But I just wanted to kind of get a sense of, you know, if she understood at the time the weight of this character, because there were lots of one-off gay male characters in the 70s before.
Oh,
this.
Yeah. And I've, you know, we've talked about it much on this show. Bob Newhart had one that was in a couple of episodes. Mm-hmm. Mary Tyler Moore, Phyllis's brother, who played by actual gay man Robert Moore. All in the Family had recurring drag queen character, I do believe, but that also, judging books by covers, which we talked about last week, etc. Yeah, like it was the problem of the week, the gay problem of the week.
Yeah. But women, lesbians, really didn't get that kind of representation. There were a lot of killer queer lipstick lesbian type stereotypes, never really coming out this way. And so Alice is a Jewish lesbian woman who dates a woman throughout the course of the show. And she lives with Jody after, you know, her failed suicide attempt. She goes to live with Jody. And they eventually start raising his baby together. And what I thought was kind of fascinating about that is it's like this sort of queer camaraderie. Like they're a couple, even as it's never implied to the audience that they are a physical couple. They're two queer people. And in fact, that is why Jody loses custody of his baby, because his the baby's grandmother, not his mother, but the other woman, she says, you know, two homos raising a baby is just one homo too many. And so she says that she threatens him. She says, if you don't get rid of Alice, I'm going to take possession of the baby. And there's not a judge in the world who would give custody to a gay man.
God.
And that's when Alice runs off and we never hear from her again. But that's after 9 episodes.
Yeah, it's substantial. So let's dive into unpacking all of this soapy goodness. Oh, wow. The title of the show lends itself to adjectives. This week on Must Have Seen TV, we'll be talking about the soap episode 216 and also a bit of 217. They're the 16th and 17th episodes of season 2. They're written by Susan Harris and Stu Silver and directed by Jay Sandrich. Here's how iTunes describes the episode, which I think gives an indication of the show's structure. The police capture Dutch. Jody makes friends with Alice. Mary leaves Bert. Eunice returns home, and Corinne goes into labor. So, how accurate would you say that is in describing the episodes?
I think it's pretty accurate. That's it.
I have to say, this is probably the easiest... I always want to know how people write the summaries, because in a way, you would think soap might be the easiest, because they're giving you very clear, like, here are five plot lines, you just sum up. But I also do think that a lot of the summaries are written by an intern watching literally the first 30 seconds, and then, like, what do they think? And then it goes... And if you did that with soap, it wouldn't work.
Yeah, it's a lot to follow. But at the beginning and end of every episode, there's always a, here's what you missed on soap.
Roddy!
Yeah.
Roddy! Like, when I saw that name on IMDb, it was just like, oh, my sick day best friend from watching Price is Right as a kid. Ugh.
The tagline was something like, confused? You won't be after watching this episode of soap. And then, of course, by the end of the episode, you're still confused, just about slightly different things.
I like, so the Rod Roddy's introduction to episode 2, when he's summarizing what happens to Jody and Alice in episode 1, he says, they're both depressed and gay.
And gay.
Which I was just like, man, I love, that's accurate. You know?
Oh, yeah. It takes me back to that, like, that early instructional film where it's like, you know, are you having trouble spotting the homosexual? You may run into this mentally ill person at blah, 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 blah. Like, oh, that makes sense.
So, like, we don't have to talk about the entire episode in plot order, because obviously all inconsequential to what we actually want to talk about.
Yeah.
But I do want to point out, like, the cast of this show, if you're someone that's watched a shit ton of sitcoms but have never actually watched soap, like the first scene where all of them are getting drunk at the bar, I was like, oh, Empty Nest. Oh, and Blossom. Oh, wait, who's the boss? Sports Night. Like, just kept going on. Good for Blossom's dad, Ted Waz.
I mean, it's always a good who's who of... This would have been such a fun show to guest star on, but it's a great who's who of you know, people who come around in the 80s. It's, you know, we're playing in two stables. We're playing in Norman Lear stable. Because, you know, Susan Harris is coming from that. And so we have a lot of the actors coming off those shows. And then we're going into basically Susan Harris's kingdom, right? With the Golden Girls coming after soap. And so you see a lot of these characters, or a lot of these actors show up on the Golden Girls too. Richard Mulligan plays, you know, the lead in the Golden Girls spinoff, Empty Nest.
Yeah. Well, and he's also in a couple episodes of that. Also, Nurses. The fact that there was this...
Oh, yeah.
Golden Girls.
I've actually, like, never seen Nurses, believe it or not.
I don't think I have, but...
Spinoff of a spinoff.
Yeah, and they all aired on Saturday night. Like, the two-parter Golden Girls Hurricane episode. I'm ready, please take me Hurricane 92 or whatever. That was, like, a whole night event amongst Empty Nest, Nurses, and Golden Girls. For Nurses.
Wonderful.
Well, and also Sophia. Sophia went to Empty Nest after Golden Palace ended.
Yes.
And she
She was also on Blossom too, or Who's the Boss, or one of those other shows.
Yeah, God.
She showed up in a lot of, it's the Golden Girls cinematic universe, right? She's the Loki character who jumps from show to show.
Well, yeah, you would want that. That makes sense for her. Good for her. So I like that. There's something interesting about the very first scene of the episode is all the guys at the bar, and Jody is there amongst them. I can't really remember, like, why they're all drinking or what they're commiserating over, because, again, I'm jumping in midway.
Right, you know? Right.
But I do that he's one of the guys. Also, I guess because he isn't super gay.
So the person he's sitting next to is his stepfather, Bert Campbell, who's played by Richard Mulligan. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of what soap has to do, and this is probably why you didn't remember it from Nick at Night or maybe even TV Land. It is, you know, when you watch the shows on, you want to be able to watch whatever episode you can, whichever night you're watching.
Yeah.
Just randomly drop in on an episode. You obviously can't do that very well with soap, even though it sort of tells you what was happening. And there's still some gags that you can get by just watching one episode. it's very hard to just fall into it. So it's not good for syndication generally. But a lot of what happens in the early parts of episode is just heavy exposition, catching people up. And so in that scene, they're all at the table and they're all talking about their various woes. So Jody's specifically talking about losing Carol, the mother of his child, Wendy, and Dennis from an earlier season, who was his gay lover. And then there's, you know, the character with the puppet. I can't ever remember who that was.
I did really like, I mean, it takes a lot to make a ventriloquist dummy, like, joke and set piece not seem hacky, but, like, I liked it.
Well, that actor had to do that the whole show, so he got a lot of practice. But yeah, I was thinking the eyes are moving and it was pretty well done.
There's a really good, so this also speaks to the evolution of comedy writing amongst gay topics, because there's a moment where they're talking about, like, trying to gross each other out, and Billy or Jody's just like, I don't get grossed out. I don't get sick to my stomach. He says, and then he says, I don't even gag, which is such a missed opportunity for a gay joke. Like, gag reflex is one of, like, nowadays that is just like a stock, you know, he doesn't have a gag reflex because he can perform fellatio. Yeah, so, but like in 1978-79, they're not doing that, or don't know that that's potentially like an inside joke amongst gay culture.
I think what it is they are trying to make jokes around censors.
Yeah.
And so here's the thing you have to know about soap is, you know, soap is coming from that Norman Lear stable. So they're clearly very aware of what it is they're doing. They're making a message, but soap wasn't able to be as controversial as a Lear show. It just couldn't be. Before it even premiered, it had 56,000 protest letters, and by the time we get to the second season, they have neutered Jody as much as possible, which I think is part of the reason why they introduced this lesbian character, is to sort of get a chance to go back to talking about gay topics, which they kind of weren't allowed to do because they had pissed off both gay advocacy groups and conservative groups.
Yeah.
And so I imagine that little things like that, that may seem like missed opportunities, were just the closest they could get without a censor, like, being like, wait a minute.
Every time that I write about, one of these old gay episodes of television, I always look and see was the person playing the gay character gay themselves? Was it written by a gay person or directed by a gay person? And in some cases, like the Mary Tyler Moore one is co-written by Dick Clare, who... Listeners, go back and listen to my biography episode of Dick Clare, where you'll learn all about cryogenics.
Oh, heavens.
Because Dick Clare is the reason why you can get cryogenically frozen in California. And if you buy Mama's Family today, you are giving fractions of cents to cryogenics technology.
Really? Okay. Yeah.
Because he created Mama's Family, and like,
he willed
like a portion of his residuals to the like main cryogenics freezer company. So
how funny.
Yeah, it's really wild. But like, so that episode, there's a real feeling of truth to it because you have Robert Moore playing Phyllis's gay brother.
Yeah.
And you have it written by Dick Clare. Whereas if you go to like the Barney Miller episodes, it's like, it's as straight can be. It's like, it's not as... and I was really hoping that Stu Silver was a member of the Pride or whatever, but no.
Yeah.
He's not.
What I will say about... So remember when I talked about Mary Hartman a second ago?
Yeah.
And Mary Hartman... Basically, when I was working with Norman Lear on a history of this, and he told me that basically his adage was make it as taboo as possible, because the reigning televisual form in the 70s and obviously in the 80s was the daytime tabloid talk show, right? And those are syndicated shows. They do not have network budgets. Donahue famously talks about how they had to come up with a strategy in order to be able to compete with a show with Monty Hall giving away $5,000 to a woman dressed like a chicken salad sandwich. And the way to do that was to stray into the taboo, to talk about things that they knew network shows would not talk about. And so for Mary Hartman, that became all about issues of sexuality. Mm. Not only Mary's sexuality and her frustration with her husband's impotence, but then later Mary gets a gay couple as her neighbors. And what we get is actually on Mary Hartman, we get something like 55 episodes of this sort of slow queer building of this story. It's much better done than soap. But what I think is interesting about soap in the same way that that was interesting is that we're telling a queer story in a very different way than other sitcoms were, because when you watch Judging Books by Covers, you know, All in the Family, it's really, you know, the gay character is mostly there just as a complication for Archie Bunker.
Oh, yeah.
We don't really care about that character. We care about Archie Bunker's reaction to that character.
Yeah.
Whereas I think with Alice in some ways, but especially with the characters in Mary Hartman, because we know we're going to have multiple episodes over which we can tell this story, we can do it in a queer time. We can do it in a much slower sort of coming to terms and coming to realization sort of a time frame that I think makes a much more fascinating queer character than just, you know, a very special episode of character.
That's why it's so rare. I mean, that's why I like Howard Hessman on Bob Newhart's show so much, is because he was on the show like 3 or 4 times before. Then okay. They outed him as gay in multiple seasons. Like, he's in season two, season three, and then season four, they out him and he has like a whole episode built around him. And then he comes back one more time in season 5 for another episode built around him about him being a playwright. And it's like, they didn't just throw him in a closet.
Write him
so like, oh my God. I mean, they don't mention him being gay in that episode, but he is a playwright. And the problem is that he's written a play that is very similar to the therapy group. So it's really, like, that's really interesting. And when you think about like the Cheers with the Boys in the Bar is an episode that I really love. But again, Carla, Norm, and Cliff get off easy by they're bigoted the entire episode. They don't really learn anything. And at the end of it is like, they're still bigoted. Diane got really good digs in. Sam had an evolution. But then the rest of them, our faves are problematic. But I really like, so in this episode, when Jody is on the Triborough Bridge with Alice and like sees her for the first time, It's really well done. It's very dramatic. And like they pack in a lot of punch in just, I mean, the scene is what? 90 seconds? 2 minutes?
Yeah, it's very short. It's it just definitely like it'll hit you though. I mean, if you let it sneak in, it'll really get you, because she talks about disappointing her father and how much she really loved her father. And she says she loses her partner and her job and her life. And she goes, with choices like that, you either commit suicide or you kill yourself.
Yeah.
And it can be played for humor, but it's also something you can watch. And as a queer person, especially, feel like you've been there. And holy shit, this is not, because, you know, in 1979, the Gay Liberation Front is really championing everyone coming out, because the best way of advancing gay liberation is for more and more visibility.
That was Harvey Milk's whole thing. He was assassinated in late 78.
Oh, I'm not sure.
So I'm not trying to see if like Harvey Milk assassination 78. Yeah. So he died in this TV season.
But what I'll say is, I come from a very, very small town in Northwest Kansas. And, you know, watching this episode at a time when coming out was something that should have, you know, that on other TV shows was heralded as sort of this brave act, what you get to see with Alice's character is actually, no, I mean, it can and does launch people into really horrible situations, not of their choosing.
Yes.
And it isn't always just this liberatory neoliberal, self-actualization moment, but sometimes it's really something that can send you into extreme alienation.
Yeah.
And I loved that about Alice. I think Alice is a far more interesting character than Jody.
Yeah, I mean,
personally.
Even in just watching these total of like maybe 4 minutes of content across 2 episodes, or maybe 5 minutes, like, she is funny. She's just a great performer.
Yes.
It is very hard for guest stars to come on shows and like really hold their own with the regulars. Like, yeah. First of all, for the writers to give them jokes to begin with. Yes. Second of all, for them to actually do it. And she comes on in that bridge scene, and it's a scene where she's about to kill herself, and she still has so many great delivery, timing, chemistry. She's just really good.
Can I tell you just a quick anecdote from Randy?
Oh, please.
I thought it was the best. I was very young when I did my interview. You can listen to the whole thing on YouTube. But I was very young when I did it. So I was like, can you just take her back yourself to 1979? She goes, I don't remember. Here are a couple things that I remember. And the one that she shared that I thought was the most interesting is this is really like her third actual gig. She moves from New York to LA. She's like not really done anything. This is obviously the biggest thing. So she invested all of her savings into getting a perm. Because a perm was, you know, really big in the day. It made you look sort of edgy and you know, it was like the hot hairstyle at the time. And they cast her with the perm, as she thinks, because she thought that they just thought that she had curly hair. And she said at a certain point in the scripting or in rehearsals, it became very clear that my curly hair was a problem. Because they were very nervous about Alice looking too edgy or too cool, or, you know, there's a great line on that bridge where he says, you don't look like a lesbian. And she goes, oh, I loaned my black leather outfit to one of the Hell's Angels.
Yeah.
But so she said, like, one of her first actual paid gigs was sitting in a chair as the producers of the show hired someone to straighten her hair when she had invested all of her savings on this perm. And like the first gig she lands, it's like they spend a day straightening her hair. And she said that is just such a fitting, you know, portrait of what Hollywood actually is. But they were so nervous because they knew the weight of the character and, you know, what it was they were going to do. They were really earnestly trying to make her into a sympathetic character. And sometimes, you know, maybe they fail. Sometimes they actually succeed beautifully, in my opinion. But that was something that really stuck with her. And it has, you know, for 40 years that she goes to her first job, she spends all her money on this hairstyle, and then they spend the next day trying to get it out.
I mean, there's also something about the queer experience to that, like having to conform.
Yes.
To what the network censors want. In the second half of the storyline that we see in these two episodes, like the first part is the averted suicide, thank God. You know, they find kindred spirits. They're both going through it. You know, we love a gay alliance. Then the second, in 217, we see that she's already moved in and has been there for a couple weeks. I think
it's quite a jump. For a show that like is supposed to be very incremental with its storyline. I rewatched it yesterday and I thought, oh, did I miss an episode? Have I scanned the wrong episode? But no. Yeah, they just jump right into them being sort of queer roommates.
Yeah, it's very, I mean, lavender marriages were very much a thing in your 1940s and 50s, etc. Where the gay men would marry the lesbians so they would avoid, you know, persecution, firing,
et cetera,
you know, lovely stuff.
Although these two are out.
Yeah, and they aren't, they also, so the vibe of the whole scene, because he comes home and it's like, she's rearranged the furniture, she shampooed my carpet, she's made
painted
dinner.
Painted the bathroom.
Like, yeah, like painted, like, he's like, oh, it's very domestic, and she's treating him like, you know, the Jewish mother, which is what she, like, you know, says she's acting like, she loves the bathroom because it's gorgeous silver and it's like going to a disco. Which, yes. But like there is a very like, oh, it is homebodies. It is domestic.
Yeah.
It is, yeah, it really does. It's almost like we see the almost immediate softening of her character just from those episode to this episode in a way. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they have to really set up because, you know, she's not a main character. She's obviously just a side character. And so they're really conditioning us to the next major Jody storyline for the season, which is he's going to have this baby. This baby is going to be given to him. He's going to have to be in a situation then where the home feels, I mean, because, you know, there's also trying to balance like Utah and Alabama's viewers with New York City and San Francisco's viewers. And so they're really conditioning the home and making Jody into this sort of domestic character in order for us to, you know, because the other kind of representation is just the nightclub gay who lives, you know, by the seat of his pants and spends all his time farting.
Can that be a character on soap? No, no,
no, no, no, no, no, no. But it allows us to think differently about what it means to be a gay person. And often, truly, what it means to be a gay person is just like a homebody who nests and buys a lot of items for our collections.
Especially over the last year.
Absolutely. I mean, I can see your collection behind you, and behind me I have this Golden Girls skateboard, and there's a Golden Girls bobblehead, and there's a calendar. And
I got my Golden Girls.
Blanche is
right
up
there
on the wall. So in some ways,
within my hand's reach, I have a heart-to-heart TV guide and a Bewitched TV guide. So,
oh my! So in some ways, it's really an honest portrayal of gay life.
Yeah. What this makes me start thinking about is, like, growing up, I knew Billy Crystal as just like Billy Crystal. You know, Robin Williams,
yeah,
Martin Short,
same,
Billy Crystal.
Same.
He's just like, he's fucking Billy Crystal. But like, knowing how, in 1997, Ellen and Laura Dern, like, got hard canceled. Like, could not, yeah, look, Laura Dern could not work because she played a lesbian. She, a straight woman, played a lesbian on television.
Right.
And so it really is wild to me that Billy Crystal played a homosexual, queer, questioning.
Yeah.
Such an iconoclastic, like, firebrand of a character that people protested, and he still became Billy Crystal. I mean, I guess there's also some sexism because he's still like a white man, so of course he got,
yeah,
a second, third, fourth, fifth chance. But it is, I don't know, I don't know anything about Billy Crystal's like 1980s career, but I really am kind of fascinated at how he pivoted post soap into like doing whatever he wanted.
I think Billy, so the people who are watching soap who are making it successful were the people who are hate watching it first.
Mm.
Sort of like, you know, the watchdog groups. But, you know, the younger millennials were watching this show and they grew with Billy Crystal. So I think Billy Crystal is successful because of this major watershed character, because he was so impressionable, you know, because he was such a big deal. I mean, everyone was talking about him in,
yeah,
a way that they weren't earlier gay character. So,
I also imagine that it being kind of syndication allergic, like it's a verse you can't,
yeah,
really syndicate,
yeah,
it means
kinda,
it like
kinda,
it didn't stick around with him because soap wasn't in reruns while his like big eight, like when City Slickers came out, soap was not being rerun regularly.
Well, it probably would have been, but you know, in very subjugated time slots.
Yeah. So
it was, yeah, definitely more successful in syndication than something like Mary Hartman, but certainly a much trickier sell for something like TV Land or Nick at Night.
Yeah. It is also weird that Benson spun off of this, which again, I've never seen Benson,
yes,
but like from what I know about Benson is like, it's not this.
No. Yeah. Yeah. So Benson was their butler, the rich family's butler.
Richard Guillaume.
Yeah. Just this wonderful sort of, there's just this wonderful experimentation with genre in the sitcom form that's happening in the 70s and into the 80s that's really allowing us to think about comedy very differently. You know, obviously the sitcom form had been pretty rigid for several decades before this. And now we're really experimenting with, you know, no audiences or laugh tracks only, or we're experimenting with genre or different kinds of characters or different leads. So the 70s are my favorite era of television just because there's so,
yeah,
much experimentation and identity play. And I think this character and this show is probably best known for that, even though it was certainly not the first.
Yeah.
You know, there was a trans leading character. This is part of the reason I do this job. There, you know, there are so many fascinating things that are lost to history. There was,
yes,
a transgender leading character in 1978. on a major television show. And that was a TV show, very short-lived, still had 65 episodes, but it was called All That Glitters. And it was a show in which, and it's another thing that I've worked with Norman on, but it was this show that, you know, essentially the two genders were flipped. So women were the sexual harassers. They were the ones who ran the corporations. And then men were the sexy secretaries who were sleeping their way to the top. Obviously very binary in terms of gender performance, but the idea was to make gender weird.
Yeah.
And so the Munsters, what's the character's name who's normal, quote unquote, normal?
Marilyn.
Yes. So the Marilyn in this story world is a trans woman played by Linda Gray, you know, pre-Dallas. And her character is a trans woman who acts in a familiar way to the audience. So she does yoga. She, you know, like takes care of herself. She like puts on beauty products. And all of those things are very suspect to the women in this topsy-turvy world because they are male performing, right? So yeah. She like seems kind of like a guy, but she's a woman. But of course, when we're watching it, she just seems like a quote unquote regular woman. So these little beautiful queer histories, that is why I do this job. It's so fascinating to get to watch them. And so I went to Beverly Hills and I was in Norman's papers and I was reading letters from viewers who had watched the show. And most of them were written by women who were working. And they wrote it on their company letterhead and they were protesting that the show was being canceled because they felt seen in some way. Because it was, you know, you saw women sexually harassing men and that feels weird to watch because, you know, you don't see that in real life. And so when you see it, you start thinking differently about your own lived reality. Anyway, so I think that a lot of what, you know, comedy is doing and a lot of what these shows are doing with, you know, experimenting with identity, I think is just fascinating. And the 70s are a really fascinating time.
Well, that's something in looking at all the gay of the week episodes of the 70s, they are... I do think that it is, and I talk about this maybe too much on the podcast, I don't know. about how, like, if you look at the progression of how gay people or queer people are presented in sitcoms throughout the decades, you can very easily, like, track what the public thought of them. Because there is no aggressive homophobia in the Mary Tyler Moore and Bob Newhart Show ones. Like... The gay characters have dignity, they get jokes, they have laugh lines, the fact that they're gay is a problem, but the fact that other characters find it a problem is the problem that has to be dealt with. I mean, Bob Hartley says things to Howard Hessman, Mr. Plager's character, that it's just like, I wish my parents had said that stuff to me. Like, it's, and this is 1976 or whatever. But then when you get to the 80s, you feel the AIDS, like you feel the plague aspect, shame, and the, which is emblematic of Cheers, the boys in the bar, which is like, literally, we do not want these plague characters coming in and making our bar a gay bar. And so that's why I think that the 70s are this really interesting look at how the world could have been if people took AIDS seriously and didn't just say that it was killing all the right people. Go back and listen to my episode with Chris Vile about that Designing Women episode. So that's why I think like shows like Soap and All That Glitters they're very interesting peeks at like how things could have been. But I also think that's why Alice is very interesting, is because she's not the model minority kind of gay that comes, that's out there. I mean, like, in Judging Books by Covers is, you know, hesitate to call anything the first, but is that the first sitcom episode to actually, like, have, like, a gay plotline?
No, but it is probably the most widely acknowledged as the first.
What is the first?
That is what I say. Here's the thing. Is it only when a character says, quote unquote, I am gay or I am a homosexual? Because, you know, obviously we've had these gay characters
Uncle Arthur
from time immemorial.
Yeah, Uncle Arthur is a gay character. I mean, I firmly
believe yeah, that. For sure.
No, but I think like all in the family judging books book covers is the first one where like homosexuality really, is the central plot point, and there's an actual gay character on the show who has to like, but I mean, he is
of national television for sure.
Yeah, he's a masculine presenting John Wayne Charlton Heston looking like former football player, you know. Yeah. There's this very perfect, like, all the gay people on television have to like have it all together. And to see Alice in her first thing be like, no, I want to kill myself because it's actually hard is very revolutionary.
It really is. It really is. You are so right about the 80s. It's really fascinating how stark the difference in TV politics was between 79 and 80. And that's something that I teach in my Golden Girls class because, you know, Maude is this big celebrity, you know, Bea Arthur's this big celebrity in the 70s. When they are pitching the Golden Girls, the network is like, no, we cannot have Bea Arthur on this series because she had an abortion in the 70s on television. She's much too liberal. We can't have that. So for a long time, they just had a quote unquote Bea Arthur type, and Elaine Stritch tried to play it. It didn't work. Ultimately, the only way they sold it was that since it would be an ensemble cast, Bea Arthur's trumpeting liberalism would be muted. But you're absolutely right when you talk about how 80s televisual politics are really a strong return to conservative principles and ideals. The family-oriented shows, that these 70 shows were not. They were really trying things very differently. And you just see there is a cataclysmic difference even between 79 and 80 in terms of what television is doing. I think is just really, because it's so rare that those politics line up specifically with the decades, but they do here.
Oh, it was very, I mean, Reagan had a strong hold on. I mean, I don't like 80s sitcoms. I think I like maybe one handful of 80s sitcoms because I don't like family sitcoms generally.
Yeah, yeah.
And the 80s is just like a Growing Pains, Silver Spoons, TGI, well, not even TGIF, but that's later on, but like it's just nonstop kids being cute and adults being like, whoa.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, neo-50s. I think that I like the exceptions in the 80s sitcom world.
Cheers is my favorite. Golden Girls are my, like, Golden, those. Got
absolutely.
It.
Roseanne, for sure.
Night Court, you're bizarre.
I think what, you know, in terms of sitcoms in the 80s, what I find the most fascinating are the syndicated sitcoms. So did you ever see Small Wonder? Do you know anything about Small?
I know about it.
Oh my god, it's so great. They keep this little robot girl in the closet. If her secret is revealed, it's so queer.
The 80s had, was it a Showtime original sitcom with a gay lead character or a gay ensemble character? It was a sitcom. It was on one of those like pay cable channels.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, but like, again, they could do that. But again, because it was like Cinemax or HBO or something or other.
There are a lot of really, I mean, I think there was a show called Midnight. Was it Midnight Caller that had a character who was a bisexual man who had HIV or AIDS and was like intentionally spreading it to people. So there was definitely just as much really problematic.
Wait, but that wasn't a sitcom, was it?
No.
It's like, Jesus Christ.
I mean, we might watch it today as a sitcom, I think it was like a procedural. But the shows that we know well as 1980 sitcoms are that sort of return to family, you know, 50s kind of cookie cutter house sort of sitcom. Whereas there were a lot of really fascinating and very strange shows that I would call queer that we don't maybe know as well because they were not successful in syndication or because didn't do well in reruns. Yeah.
Soap didn't fare that well. I mean, it's kind of evident, like, Soap didn't fare that well in the 80s. Like, it ran from 78 to 82-ish?
Yeah, it was a fairly short-lived show. I mean, it's a hard premise.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But it seems like that, you know, a show pushing all those buttons is not going to do that well in Reagan America. Yeah.
And so what's so funny about the show, you know, so there's this great line by this author, I think it's Joshua Gamson in his book Freaks Talk Back, that is all about, you know, queer guests on tabloid talk shows. And he says that tabloid talk shows learned the lesson that tolerance is boredom's offspring. The idea that the more and more and more you represent taboo topics, the less interesting it becomes, the more normalized it becomes, the more you have to like amplify those topics. And so as soap continues, it gets more and more bizarre. There's a UFO at some point.
On board. I need to watch those episodes.
But strangely, they run in the opposite direction with Jody's character, perhaps because of AIDS and HIV, but he eventually just gets hypnotized into this other character who, you know, spoiler alert, thinks he's like a 90-year-old Jewish man. So they completely castrate him by the end of the show.
Jesus.
He has absolutely no sexual inclinations at that point. And that is as he's trying to figure out if his feelings for a woman are... So as the show is getting more and more taboo, they're actually really running away from taboo when it comes to the gay character, which is fascinating.
The thing that they started being the most taboo about.
I mean, you're going to get a lot of people watch that show to figure out what the hell is going to happen with Jody. And then they just ran away from it.
Oh my God. Well,
mistakes were made.
So many. Are you ready for some must-have facts that definitely don't compare to anything you've been able to tell me?
Yes.
Jesus Christ.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So I tried to find the actual ratings for the specific episode.
Okay.
The Nielsen's that week did not go past the top 20 or whatever, but it was number 19 for the season.
Oh, wow.
Which is, okay. I mean, this is season two. The top five shows this week, and I think this is very indicative of like where we are at in 1979 television. Number five was the Super Bowl postgame. Number six was Mork and Mindy. Number five was the Super Bowl postgame. Number three, tied for three, was Happy Days and Three's Company.
Okay.
Two was Laverne and Shirley, and one was the Super Bowl. And this is why I think that like 1978 to 82 is a dead zone for me.
Yeah, nostalgia running crazy.
It is. Happy Days just dominate. Happy Days and its spinoffs just dominating that.
Ugh. Yeah.
And no thanks. I don't know. So from when Bob Newhart ends in 78 to when Cheers debuts is like. Taxi's
well,
there. It's like,
I tell you, Norman burned out too. I mean, people's interest in the radical televisual era really burns out by the mid to mid late 70s.
Yeah.
And then you have this period, I think ABC goes for what's called TNA television. Or Jiggle Television.
Ooh, Three's Company, right?
It's all of its shows are like primarily just about exploitation of the body. Whereas
Heart to Heart was on ABC, so Robert Wagner was like, shirtless a lot.
The other philosophy is let's just make America great again. That philosophy, which was actually one of Reagan's mottos.
Yeah,
and so that we have a lot of nostalgia television that takes us back to the 50s with Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley. Grease on at the movies, etc.
Yeah, very, very, very weird time. The ABC Thursday night lineup that this episode aired as part of was Mork and Mindy, followed by Angie, then Barney Miller and Soap, which I think are complimentary, and then the drama Family closed out the night. Which can't think of a more generic name.
This was this Thursday, did you say?
Yeah, ABC Thursday night.
Wow, okay. I didn't know that.
What's your hot take on Mork and Mindy?
I'm not sure I have a hot take. I mean, I enjoyed Robin Williams' performance. I think it's like, it's not revolutionary television. So no. It's been a number of years since I've seen
it. I haven't watched it since Nick at Night.
In that diegesis.
And I, or it might have been TV Land, I don't know, but like I really liked it back then. I thought the fact that Jonathan Winters was a baby was hilarious. Busted out of that egg. On IMDb, 51 users rated this episode a 7.9. Episode 216.
Interesting. Okay.
What do you think? Is that too high, too low for soap? Is this a 7.9?
I mean, and I think I said this at the beginning of the episode, episodes don't really matter for soap. Yeah. So, like, if you think about this episode, I mean, they all, I think probably those raters are people who, what they're doing is they're binging the series.
Just going through eight.
Yeah.
Or weirdos, you know, like me who would actually get very granular about literally, and I did TV.com. Anyone remember that website from the early 2000s?
Yes.
I used to go through and rate everything.
Oh my.
But yeah, what would you rate the Alice story arc though on a scale of 1 to 10?
It's and I may be biased because, you know, I had this wonderful experience interviewing Randy, and you know, we got this on the Huffington Post.
Oh wow.
And so like I have this just this love letter to this particular character who I think is, and the other thing is Alice never gets any quote unquote screen time in conversations about gay history. The first time I ever saw Alice mentioned in like a GLAAD timeline or anything, they had just ripped off my screen grab from the episode from that. And I felt really good about it too. Like, oh, I made this, like, I had this small sort of difference in queer TV history. And so I think that Alice is a really fascinating character. I think Randy is a brilliant performer, and especially knowing that it's like her first role.
Really. Yeah.
It's her first major role. And I think that the show, it shows us a different kind of queer way of being. So I think that, you know, if I'm giving it a 10, I'm giving it an 8 or a 9. I think the characters in Mary Hartman were more narratively interesting, but I like Alice a lot.
Yeah.
I would like hang out with Alice.
For sure.
I would watch a show about Alice.
She should have been Alice.
Yeah. Yes. So if I consider this an episode, which you really can, because like if you add up all the minutes that she's on screen, it's probably about one episode.
No, we didn't even talk about the fact that a character reveals they're pregnant and gives birth in the span of 20 minutes.
Yeah.
So like there's a lot going on in these two episodes that
yeah. And the
which
other
I
thing,
love. Go for it.
Not in either of these two episodes, but later on, Alice has a woman that she's dating. And Randy told me in the rehearsal with that actress, and she couldn't remember her name. And I wasn't good before the interview today and looked it up. But she said, you know, in the rehearsal, she goes to kiss her. And the network, you know, is like, no. You couldn't even have a perm. You honestly thought we were going to let you kiss her.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous. She goes, but she's my girlfriend. Why wouldn't I kiss her? So the two characters physically never interact. So there are definite limitations to Alice, but in some ways, those limitations really mirror the queer reality or the reality of queer people. Like I don't hold my partner's hand in public because of the potential safety ramifications of doing that in the state of Georgia.
Yeah,
and
I've
knowing...
been told not to do that in front of my family. So
fun
stuff.
I really think that this character, you know, she's so lost in the history and the timeline that I really encourage everyone watch the show specifically just to get through these episodes, because what you will be seeing when you watch them is a character that made a difference for a lot of people. And that's something that Randy told me too. You know, a lot of the advocacy groups, the, you know, watchdog groups, they were really pissed about the character. but a lot of people weren't. And for a long time, it was very meaningful for her when people would come up and say, your show, your character made a difference. You were the reason that I didn't jump. And the weight of that and understanding how television can be so meaningful for people makes this character a 10 for me.
Yeah.
Just knowing she saved lives just by being.
Well, I mean, that I think that answers who had the must see performance and also must other people see this episode, which I think is, yeah, it's really great. Good for Alice. I'm glad that we got to talk about her.
I am so glad we got
to. And tell people there's more to Soap than just Jody.
And if you love Ida Blankenship, you can watch the entire storyline of Ida Blankenship, which, you know, she's a major character in the show too, even though you can put all of the time that she's on screen into 12 minutes and you can watch it all on YouTube. Same with Randy's character in Soap. Not on screen very much, but made a huge difference.
Randy is a gay icon in multiple ways.
Yeah, and
Ida Blankenship, gay icon. I mean,
and later, she's in a Grey's Anatomy episode where she plays a lesbian woman whose partner has cancer. And you know, no one at Grey's probably had any idea about Alice, but I know that somewhere in Randy's heart, like, she was remembering how important this character had been for her. And by the way, she said she was hesitant to take the role because she knew at first that there might be potential implications for a young career starting by playing gay. And she finally just thought, well, fuck it. This sounds like a really interesting character and the show is doing interesting things. And she did it. And who knows what her career would be without it, even if she's not well remembered for it. God. But I will say, I went to her Wikipedia page before this interview, and I noticed that it says that she played one of the first recurring lesbians on TV. And I thought, I have some small part in that because of that HuffPost piece, because absolutely it did not belong on, or it did not appear in her bio before then. Because I felt like, wow, if I stumbled onto something, why is no one talking about this? It's such a fascinating character.
God. Yeah, and that is... I know that feel. That's the fun. That is why we.
That is why we do it.
Do what you do, and that's et cetera. I'm not gonna get wistful. I still got 4,000 more words of a writing sample to get done at some point.
I feel your pain. Writing is hard.
It is easy once I get going. Well, also I've done 11 months of. Very meticulous and ridiculous organization and stuff. So it really is just connecting all the dots that are already written down. So it's flown by.
You know, one of the things I said to Norman Lear when I first sat down with him was, thank you for trusting me with this. And, you know, he's, to the end of his time, a funny person. So he goes, I don't know who the hell you are. and you know, he was joking about it, but it was really kind of funny because the idea is he's giving me the time of day because I'm talking about this thing no one else is talking about. And he was interested in why I was interested in all that glitter.
Yeah.
And you're doing the same thing. You know, the person who is the subject of your work may quote unquote have no idea who you are. But nevertheless, you are birthing this baby into the world that is going to be so meaningful in their life and is really going to make a difference in people who have this passion and this knowledge, or maybe have no idea that this actually happened. That is what will keep you going, really.
It is really weird because I mean, like, Hayden Rourke died when I was 3. So it is really weird to be like, I'm investing so much time in this person. And it's a very like weird aspect of my job. Like, when you write a nice thing about a celebrity, you like it when they give the RT or they fave the tweet.
Sure.
You know, it's like the like tiny little modicum of like, oh, good. They like, it's like Hayden will never, like, he's dead. He's fully like, but when his, you know, his partner who's still alive, or his nieces, or his sister-in-law, who I just met in person on Sunday. Like, when they tell me, like, Hayden would love this, or Hayden would like this thing you did, or Hayden would be so happy. It just, like, it feels very nice, and it feels very, like, rewarding.
Vindicating.
Yeah. So, everyone write in questions about Hayden Rourke, and I'm going to do a episode about this year journey. Hopefully the book will be out next year, because I'm not going to take a long time. That's what
he
says.
Best of luck to you.
That's what he says now. We'll see.
Done is better than perfect. That is the motto for writing.
Oh, yeah. Where can people find your work and et cetera on the internet to find out more about your life?
Well, you know,
your
adventure, your
journey.
I've published academically. So if you're in a class, there's obviously, you can convince your professor to teach my work, and that will help me personally. I also wrote for the Huffington Post for a couple of years. I've done podcast episodes. If you search Taylor Cole Miller, you'll find me. If you search Taylor Miller, you'll find the soap opera star. So that's the way that you get to me. And I'm really just my book project right now, Queer and Repeat, is all about the queer legacy of television syndication. And so that's what I'm primarily writing about. That was what my dissertation was on. That's the book that I'm working on too. And so I understand, in the same way that you do, that writing a book is about birthing a baby, and sometimes the labor pains are a little harder than you expect them to be, but what you will end up with will be amazing.
And it'll be the only book I ever write. Just kidding.
Oh yeah, no, it won't be. Jesus, it won't Christ. Be. Well, you will find something else that will just...
I already got ideas.
Just fuel your life.
That's the problem. I got ideas already. Thank you so much for being on the show. That does it for this episode of Must Have Seen TV. Thanks again to my guest, Taylor Cole Miller.
Thank you so much for having me.
The soap
doctor.
For Dr. Taylor Cole Miller, for dropping by talking about soap. Soap? What the fuck? Soap with me. I don't edit these. So listeners, you just get whatever you want.
Soap.
Next time, I'll be discussing the biography of Hayden Rourke that I'm writing. I'm probably going to include the part of the interview with Jackie Cox from Drag Race that I did not include in my Genie episode with Jackie earlier, specifically when I'm telling Jackie about Hayden's gay life. I might read an excerpt from what I've written so far. Like, let's just wild out. And I'll answer questions. So please submit questions via at MustHaveSeenTV on Twitter, Instagram, or... email musthaveseentv@gmail.com. Please rate and review the podcast in Apple, because it helps out. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Brett White. Read the words that I write at decider.com. Thanks to Acast for hosting this nonsense. And thanks to all of y'all for listening. And I'll see you next time on Must Have Seen TV.
Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.